Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Gavin Thurston, cameraman for award-winning nature series like Blue Planet 2, Planet Earth 2, and The Trials of Life, and many, many others. And we are talking about his new memoir, Journeys in the Wild, The Secret Life of a Cameraman. Gavin, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, it's very kind of you to want to talk to me about it, and thank you very much for reading it.
Oh, my God. Let me just say right out, anybody listening, read this book right now. That's all I can say. It's like one ripping yarn after another. For over 30 years, you've traveled on every continent and under the sea to capture that film footage that people, when they watch these natural history specials on TV, this is the footage that make you go, ah. And this book is the story of how you got a lot of these shots, but also what it's like to be a cameraman. And it's very sobering to realize what you've gone through as a cameraman.
Well, I say, looking back on it, when you see it listed end to end in a book, it does seem like quite a dramatic career. But at the time, it's just one big adventure, really, and very enjoyable.
Your first camera was a box brownie, a 12-photo box brownie. What was the photo? What was the photograph that set you off on the natural history binge?
Well, you get 12 pictures on a roll with a box brownie, and I think it was about the third or fourth picture, which was an orca completely out of the water, banging its nose on a beach ball. Now, we know, obviously, orcas shouldn't be in captivity, but at the time, that split-second moment I pushed the trigger on the box brownie, I still have that photograph almost 50 years later.
It's reproduced in the book. It's reproduced.
Yeah, yeah, that's the one. Yeah, yeah. And it's, I suppose that was the moment I realized the power of photography, that you can share a moment with other people, as I say, even nearly 50 years later. So that was that's what sparked the passion, I suppose.
What's amazing is that your sort of big break happened by pure chance with Oxford Scientific Films. You were carrying home some beer.
Well, I'd actually drunk the beer, which is why I didn't have the bus there, but, which I'm sure any self-respecting teenager would have done. Back in that day, it was okay to hitchhike, so I had a bit of cardboard, wrote Oxford Police on it in italics, in my best italics with marker pen, and I got a lift in a 1962 Bentley, which on reflection sounds a little bit dodgy, expensive car driven by a wealthy man, but all was good. And he knew where this place was, Oxford Scientific Films, en route to Oxford. We pulled in the car park. I got an interview with the company there and then, and the rest is history, as they say.
Does that not amaze you that it was just by happenstance that you got that break?
It does, but it's interesting. I mean, lots of people ask me how you get started or how do you get into the industry. And I think the same rule applies to anything in life, that you make your own luck, you make your own opportunities. Right. Just because you have a degree or, you might be an amazing pianist or whatever, nobody's just going to ring you up or find you to offer you a job. And I think any chance you have of making an opportunity, and for me, it was, calling into Oxford Scientific Films with my portfolio the day I left school. And that was my plan. It just so happened that I got a lift there rather than taking the bus. It might have been, if I hadn't got the lift, it might have been I'd gone home and nursed a hangover, wouldn't have got that interview, and I'd probably be working at a checkout in Walmart or something. I mean, who knows?
One of my takeaways from this book is how much hard work and long hours away from your family this takes. And at one point in the middle, there's a section where you're really almost living hand to mouth because you had to turn down a couple of jobs. This is tough work.
I think it's the same for anybody unless you're wealthy to start with. If you're working a full-time job and you have some bad luck, I mean, I think probably the majority of the population struggle to meet their bills every day.
Yep,
I mean, it's different
absolutely.
For me now. I can actually pay my bills now. The bank will lend me the money. I think anybody goes through those financial struggles. And for me, being self-employed and having two young boys, I think that just compounded the issue. But as I say, there's lots of families in those situations. Now, I just happen to have a break with an offer of a commercial.
You often find yourself throughout the different sections in this book, which read like a diary or a memoir, in situations where the average person would likely freak out, or you're in blinds for hours on end. And what's funny is as soon as you start filming, you become focused and you forget everything else.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think filming is a distraction. You know, you become so focused to get the image, excuse the pun, you know, and you've been waiting for ages to capture a particular bit of behavior, that when that thing starts to happen, the last thing you want to do is screw it up. So all your concentration is taken on that shot. And I've been with producers and directors who are trying to give me instructions, stood behind me. And in the moment, I'm completely deaf to that. I'm completely focused on the animal or the behavior or whatever. Yeah, so in a way, it's an escape from, you know, the worries of normal life. And I'm sure lots of people in their professions will find the same, that once, you know, if they're passionate about something and once they're really concentrating, I bet, you know, I bet a Formula One or NASCAR driver, right, as they're speeding around the raceway, isn't thinking about, you know, paying the telephone bill or taking the cat to the vet. I bet they're fully focused on the job in hand, and that's the same for me, really.
You're in blinds for so many hours, often having to go in at night to wait for the morning shot in heat and cold. Did you have to build yourself up for that stamina to sit in the blind and just sit there quietly for so many hours?
No, I mean, a lot of people think I must have a lot of patience to do this job, but for me, God, sitting in a hide or blind is just a joy, really. Yes, there's hours when there's hours when nothing happens. But then, actually, when the moment happens, say you're waiting for a gorilla to turn up in a clearing in the forest, or elephant to turn up, or whatever it might be, those moments are so magical. And also, while you're waiting for them, you're seeing other things. You're seeing birds, butterflies, dragonflies, bees, you know, hearing the wind through the trees. You've got, you know, all that time to yourself. And, I mean, it's a real privilege to have that time. You know, so many of us have really, really busy lives. We're not ever forced to kind of sit for 12 hours and just have nothing to really think about and just be distracted by nature. For me, it's a fantastic time to spend in there.
You also talk about sort of a sixth sense, which wakes you up at a critical moment. One of the weirdest ones in the book is when you were filming a lava flow on a shelf in Hawaii. Can you describe that? Because you almost bought it.
Yes, that was quite an eventful trip, I must say. So filming at the base of Kilauea, where the lava spews into the ocean, and myself and Matt, the assistant producer, we'd set up two time lapses down on the shelf, and we just retreated from the ocean edge and up off that sort of fragile shelf, you know, 100 meters or so. And it was the middle of the night. We'd been working all night. We'd been working nights in a row. Anyway, the two of us just lay down and fell asleep. And there was a moment when we both woke up at the same time. We both sat up. There was like a moment of sort of rabbit in the headlight stare at each other. We both got up and just grabbed the packs and legged it. And we realized what had happened is the lava tube, where the two lava tubes which flow out into the ocean, one of them had migrated underground and was now flowing underneath us. Whoa. And basically, we were just cooking. And between between the cracks of the lava, we could see molten lava beneath us. And thankfully, we'd woken up and not got, you know, poisoned by toxic fumes or whatever. But maybe it was pretty stupid to be sleeping on a lava tube in the first place, you might say. But yeah, it was a lucky escape.
That happens time again in this. I mean, you narrowly escaped being eaten by a pride of lions once that were stalking you and the whole group. And that was amazing. And for me, the killer was when you stopped to take a shot of beaters.
Yeah, I mean, again, by the time we were back at the car and we hadn't been eaten in that sort of tense 20 minutes or whatever, walking through the bush and being stalked, but particularly by one female, we hadn't seen the other six lionesses till we got to the car. But it was such a beautiful shot of those bee eaters on the branch that I had to grab it. Well, you know, we're there to make a film.
I totally get it. But I have to admit, I laughed out loud when you go, oh, there was this beautiful set of bee eaters on a branch. Now you're sort of slurring over this. You've been stalked by this female lion where the guide had to like shoot twice in the direction. It wasn't going to kill the lion. To like stop it from running after you, and you get back to the car and you're going, and you knew that there were other lionesses in this pride that were likely in the area, but you had to stop and get that shot.
Yeah, I was right by the car door. I don't think it was reckless. I was right. Well, I don't think it was reckless. I think the guide, tracker guide, perhaps thought I was being a bit reckless. And when he just said, get in the car. And literally when he said it with a certain urgency, I got in the car, and sure enough, that's when the other six lionesses stuck their heads up out of the grass and they tracked us the whole way. But I mean, the main thing is really, I'm really glad that he didn't shoot that lioness because...
Right. You make that very clear. You make that very clear in the book. There's even times when you miss a shot, and as you describe it in the book, it's a stunning experience that just to be there. You were in a national park looking at a female gorilla who had an interaction with the butterfly, and it's one of the most lyrical sections of the book, and yet you never captured it on film.
Oh, I've missed loads of good shots.
That one that you described was just an absolutely stunning description.
It was, because I think it just said so much about the gorilla.
Right.
So, as I said, I've been following those gorillas, and when she just snatched that butterfly out of the air and stopped chewing for a moment, held her closed hand up to her eye with a butterfly in it, slowly opened her fingers, and that butterfly came out and just fluttered off.
Wow.
And she watched it fly on by. It said so much about that gorilla and the intelligence, you know, the fact that she was thinking, what are these blooming things flying around me? And just by catching that one, looking at it, she said, it's a butterfly, really nice. Whereas, as I say, the character of a chimpanzee, it would have snatched it, shoved it in its mouth and eaten it and spat it out, probably. So, no, I thought it said a lot about the kind of gentle, inquisitive, intelligent nature of gorillas.
And you've done a lot of filming of gorillas. And
Yes, I have. I quite like them.
Well, they sound absolutely fascinating, but one of the times you actually get punched by a gorilla.
Yeah, again, I mean, on reflection, probably my own stupidity, but if you're going to hide in a blind, you know, on the edge of a clearing where gorillas, you know, frequent, and one of these intelligent, inquisitive animals happens to wander by and think, what the hell's in that bush, that strange blind of a bush? I mean, it was just an inquisitive, exploratory slap. But unfortunately, if you weigh 400 pounds, you know, that's and could eat Mike Tyson for breakfast, that exploratory slap happens to hurt quite a lot when it hits you across the back. It was, as I describe in the book, I'm not going to go into all the details. It was bloody frightening. It was really frightening. I mean, that's probably the most sustained fright I've had in my life, because it built and built and built. I kind of knew what was coming when that gorilla approached the hide.
Well, just previous to that, Dave Morgan, the researcher, was attacked by a gorilla.
Yeah, that ended a bit more seriously, a bit, you know, not so well. I'd say he was badly bitten and beaten up. So that was what was playing in the back of my mind when, you know, there's certain etiquette you follow when you meet gorillas in the forest. And if you meet them face-to-face, you can behave in a certain way. You can appear submissive and squat down and pretend to eat and make low appeasing grunting noises. But if you're hiding in a blind, your body language doesn't really help you.
No,
because the gorilla can't see it. You can't give it any signs that you're not a threat. So between reading Gorillas in the Mist and the Dave Morgan story of him being bitten days before, that's why I was absolutely... Am I allowed to say shitting myself on radio?
Yes, you can.
Very, very absolutely can.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that term means something, I can tell you. Because if you are frightened, I didn't soil myself, but...
That was amazing.
If you are frightened, you know, it's a natural fright response. You know, get rid of as much load as you can before you have to run for it. thankfully, that didn't happen.
Yet, in order to get close to... there was some kind of marsh antelope, the Sitatunga.
Yeah.
You donned a gorilla suit where there were gorillas. I love how you just go, well, yeah, of course I did.
Well, when I sent the request through to Brian back in the office in Bristol, and I said, because he was coming out, you know, the following week, and he said, do you need any supplies or anything? I said, obviously, yeah, more single malt whiskey and chocolate.
But of course.
Can you bring out a gorilla suit? And he said, why do you want a gorilla suit? And I explained the idea that I was going to dress up as a gorilla, go out into the clearing to get close to these animals, just because the animals didn't seem frightened of gorillas, but they are frightened of humans. And to give him his due, he said, yeah, okay. And sure enough, when he turned up the following week, in with the whiskey, the chocolate, and the, you know, extra film and all the rest of it, was a gorilla suit.
Did it work?
But, yes, it did. I'd say it was partly to prove a point to the scientists, Because we'd had discussions about this, and I said, you know, if I dress up as a gorilla, I bet I can get, you know, 10 feet from one of these wild antelope, because they don't bat an eyelid with gorillas around them. And they were kind of very dismissive of the idea. They did point out that if I went out there with gorillas or elephants, I would probably get killed. So I did have to choose my moment and go into the clearing when it was clear, other than the antelope. But, yeah, half an hour of tiptoeing, and I must say it was bloody hot in the sun.
Oh, my God, yeah.
In the Congo, on the equator, wearing a gorilla suit. But half an hour of tiptoeing out through the marshes with a camera and a walkie-talkie and pretending to eat grass, I got eventually within 6 feet of one of those wild Zitatunga. And as I say, normally if they saw a human, you wouldn't get within probably a mile. They just leg it because they've been poached and persecuted for years.
You're just lucky some gorilla didn't come out and look at you, because it would have been a massive insult to gorilladom to see this bloke in a gorilla suit. I can just imagine how they would feel about that.
Well, I was most worried in case it got amorous, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
That's what was the most frightening idea.
Wow.
Especially when you've got the rest of the film crew on the sidelines with a video camera filming behind the scenes. The idea of being somebody filming that, I never would have lived that down, that's for sure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Gavin Thurston, cameraman for many award-winning nature series like Blue Planet 2, Planet Earth 2, The Trials of Life. The list is endless. And we're talking about his memoir, which I think is one of the most great books to read. I just couldn't put it down. Journeys in the Wild, The Secret Life of a Cameraman. Now, Gavin, one of the very satisfying things for me is when you filmed with, and you did this numerous times, with Sir David Attenborough, and learning that he was a regular, as you put it, a top bloke. He was a good guy. You always want your heroes to be a good guy, and to learn that David Attenborough, obviously who I've admired for so many decades, to learn that he's a regular bloke is good.
No, I mean I say lots of people, I think they're not surprised when I say that. But then, you know, if you think of some Hollywood stars who need their Winnebago and their, you know, private jet and all the rest of it, David is not like that at all. He'll travel with the rest of the crew. If we're sleeping in tents, he would sleep in a tent. You know, he likes to be one of the team. He doesn't like to be singled out. And I say he has no demands at all, really. Or maybe the odd glass of wine or a piece of chocolate or maybe the occasional ice cream. But beyond that, he makes no demands at all. He's a real team player. He's obviously one of the world's best storytellers, as we've seen from all the programs, but he can turn that skill to telling a good, you know, spinning a good yarn or telling a joke. He's so knowledgeable, you know, I mean, he's a geologist, he's a, you know, one of the world experts on African art, tribal art, you know, global art. You name it, he knows about it. He knows about conservation, about science, about species, birds, you know, bees, plants, whatever.
Wow.
So it's amazing being with him as a travel companion. You can point to some weird rock formation. You say, oh, that's interesting. Well, I wonder what those black rocks are through there, through that seam. And he'll say, well, actually, what you're looking at there is a Triassic layer. And, you know, he'll tell you this whole spiel about that particular type of rock and how it's laid down and what you'd find in it. He really is a top bloke. And it's been that's kind of what's really coloured my career, working with him over the last 30-odd years. You know, I say it's just such a privilege to work with such a great man.
I can only imagine.
We can all learn something from how
Absolutely.
Humble he is. And just an amazing man.
Now, I'm not going to give away this story. People have to read the book, but you make him fall off a chair with a Monty Python song.
Yes.
Don't give any more details. Don't make people read.
I nearly killed him. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I know. You got nervous that you almost killed him. People are going to have to read the book for that. Now, a lot of people who are not used to being outside a lot are worried about insects. And you've had some interesting interactions with invertebrates. You were filming in Gabon, I think, in a hide when you got covered with African bees.
Yeah, and you're familiar with Africanized bees in the States, because they're spreading up through Mexico, Texas, and so on. And I know people are killed by them every year, you know, in accidents where you bump into a hive or whatever. Well, I was in a blind up a tree waiting to film elephants and gorillas in the forest in Gabon, so about 30 foot up, just out of elephant trunk reach. And basically, when you sweat out there, which of course you do, it's the tropics and it's hot, and you've just climbed up a tree, and you're sitting in a blind. And all the insects out there are really desperate for salt. So when one bee happens to find its way into the blind, lands on your skin and finds this salt, of course it laps it up. Then he flies home and tells his mates, and before you know it, I mean, over the next few hours, you then suddenly find yourself with maybe 1,000 bees on you. And they're not out to, you know, I counted 400 on one arm when it got to the, you know, the bad, really bad point. But don't forget, I'm 30 foot up a tree in elephant territory. And thankfully, James Aldred, who now is a fully fledged wildlife cameraman, but he's a tree expert and climbing expert, he was on the end of a radio, and I radioed him, and I said, James, I can't hold this anymore. You know, I'm going to get stung. I'm completely covered in bees. You need to come and get me out. And he developed this ground-based rescue system. So if somebody's up a tree, some idiot cameraman like me, say I passed out or got bitten by a snake up the tree or something, you know, for whatever reason was incapacitated, he can actually lower you to the ground from the ground without having to climb up. So basically, he legged it down to the forest. I don't know whether I added in the story that he actually nearly ran it. Well, he ran into some elephants on the path, but he was so hell-bent on getting to me, he ran through the group of elephants to get to me, thankfully. And I literally had to kind of fall backwards out of the hide, and I knew as soon as I leant against my shirt, I was going to squash some bees and get stung. So I think I got stung, I don't know, 50 times or something.
Whoa.
And hit the ground, unclipped the carabiner, and we just legged it through the forest and legged it into the river. There was a shallow river stream about shin deep, and just ran up the stream, making as much splash as possible to drive the following bees off. But I must say, and excuse the pun, but it's a real buzz when you get bit, stung by so many bees. I mean, that the adrenaline rush of that, if it doesn't kill you, is extraordinary. But the one thing I have discovered since that bee attack is that I have become more sensitive to bees, so I don't think I can be quite so reckless. So now I got stung in the garden, in my garden at home in England last year, and it was just one sting on my foot, and boy, did that hurt. But also, it really got my heart racing, which it never used to. So I think that's the sort of first signs of maybe an bee allergy.
So you'll carry you'll carry an epinephrine pen.
What, for the Sunday morning after, you mean? For the pick-me-up?
No.
We do carry them in our first aid kit, but you know what it's like with first aid kit.
Yeah,
you're
never
going to have it on you. It's always going to be in the car because you've got so much camera gear to carry. But no, it is something I will keep an eye on.
Towards the end of the book, there's a very grim section on Sudan. You're there to film the Dinka people in 1991, but it's a time of civil war. And that whole section I found deeply disturbing and scary. It was a totally different, it's almost like a different book at that point. And you also talk about, like, for instance, the deforestation after that, too, in places like Borneo. Are you still upbeat about humanity and the natural world?
I'm very upbeat about the natural world. I think humanity, on the other hand, humans do some ridiculous things to each other. I don't think there's any animal I know that is malicious or cruel. I mean, you might see, say, hunting dogs ripping apart an antelope, and you might say, God, that's cruel. But actually, they're out to eat it, and that death is fairly swift, really. But what humans do to each other, you know, with torturing and waterboarding and war and, you know, displacing people from the lands they live in, it's been going on for centuries, but it's still going on. You'd think, so-called intelligent species, I don't know why we have this cruelty in us and why it continues. And I'd say experiencing, you know, going through a war-torn country and seeing the suffering and seeing the destruction to the habitat and not being able to walk off the road because of mines, you know, seeing scared African teenagers, you know, boys who are like 14, 15, armed to the teeth with AK-47s and things, being made to fight for their, you know, the faction of their country. It's just appalling, and it's going on, you know, it's going on today, and it's fueled by, you know, it's fueled by the West, who want to make money out of guns and arms, right, and who want to stir up unrest. It is crazy, and I think it almost pushes me more towards nature and the natural world and away from that, you know, the bad side of humanity. And don't get me wrong, I mean, humans are extraordinarily kind people, and I hopefully that comes across in my book.
You did. You had some amazing interactions with different people all around the world.
But it's just when you see the worst of humanity and the worst that, you know, humans treat each other, you know, you're seeing the, you know, you can see the extremes on the same day.
We're going to run out of time. Is there any creature left, and I know there must be, but I just want to know what it is, that you haven't successfully filmed that you would really like to get on film?
It used to be the Holy Grail was the snow leopard, but we saw that very successfully filmed for Planet Earth and so on. But I think the next Holy Grail is the clouded leopard. And if you don't know what it looks like, Google it and have a look. It's the most extraordinary, beautiful, marbled cat. It's got slightly squat legs, but it's got the largest canines of any predator. And the reason it's got big canines and big, it's got big claws as well, is it spends much of its life up in the canopy in Indonesia and, you know, Southeast Asia, where it hunts things like monkeys. So it needs really big teeth, a bit like a kind of saber-toothed tiger type thing, because if it grabs a monkey in the trees, it needs to be able to kill it with one bite. It doesn't want to get dragged out of the tree with a fighting monkey. But because it's arboreal, it makes it particularly difficult to film. But I think we're getting there now with camera traps and camera technology and remote camera things, cable dollies. That, I think, the clouded leopard is probably the holy grail for wildlife camera folk now.
We're completely out of time, and trust me, we could be talking about this book for years. My guest tonight has been Gavin Thurston, cameraman for award-winning nature series like Blue Planet 2, Planet Earth 2, The Trials of Life. The list is literally endless. And we've been talking about his memoir, which is one of my favorite books I've read in the last year or so, Journeys in the Wild, The Secret Life of a Cameraman. Thurston, Gavin, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for your time and your interest. No, thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.